an army with a fist raised to the sky. Leading them is a mighty man with a mad rage in his eye. My name is James Conley. I didn't come here to die.
Welcome back to The Plow and Stars, and this is a special episode based on the current developments geopolitically. Particularly, I'm talking about the death of General Qassem Soleimani. If you want to support The Plow and Stars, you can listen to us on Spotify and iTunes. Our website is plowandstarspod.com. That's plow spelled P-L-O-U-G-H. Our Twitter is @plowandstars. That's, again, the archaic spelling of plow. Our Patreon is patreon.com/plowandstars. We have a Redbubble. That's redbubble.com/people/plowandstars/shop. And if you have questions, you can send a Twitter DM to @catdadeternal. That's eternal AE, @redbernard, @imdocplague, or @paymyrant, or directly to contact@plowandstarspod.com. We generally have production help from @CathariticSkelly, but he has been not doing production on the episodes that are just me. So we do have new patrons on Patreon. Again, I don't believe that they wanted to be called out on the show, so I'm not going to do that right now. But if anybody who is a patron on Patreon does want us to say anything, please let us know. DM the @PlowandStars Twitter handle, and I will do that next time. Again, it's just going to be me, Cat Dead Eternal, today, because the other hosts are busy and this is an important thing that we wanted to get out. The other hosts will be back. It's not just going to be me forever, so you don't have to be afraid that you're just going to hear my voice for the rest of the Plow and Stars run. Anyway, let's get right down to it. We're talking today about Iran. Now, Western public intellectuals have trouble thinking and speaking clearly when it comes to any international conflict. And the reason for this is that the inculcation of various provably false narratives in public discourse has become commonplace. The question, for example, of the national character of a people is something that you often hear bandied about. What are Iranians like? The truth is that imperial wars are incredibly easy to analyze if you know where to look. People who make policy decisions in the West know all about this. They've published books and articles on it. They talk to each other about it. And even in public, all the time, it is the public intellectuals who don't talk about this. They talk about all kinds of other things. And this is part of what I've called the conspiracy in plain sight that constitutes the primary body of capitalist propaganda. By hiding in plain sight and permitting retired intelligence officers, army officers to speak openly of their imperial goals, aims, stratagems, and designs, capitalism insulates itself from accusations of conspiracy and clear-eyed analysis of its functions. It's easy to say, oh, well, that's just what this one CIA agent thinks. And then you can go and later, once the crisis has passed and we no longer need to be afraid of that geopolitical reality, and go back and say, oh yes, of course the CIA agents believed this, and of course the CIA acted this way. That makes perfect sense. But during the time of crisis, the public intellectual body, that is the news media, which is controlled by the capitalists, promulgates all kinds of nonsense reasons for why the US does or doesn't do anything. The current favorite nonsense reason is, of course, that the president of the U.S. and the executive of the U.S. is completely deranged and just simply acts. But, of course, the range of actions have to be approved by all kinds of people and placed before the executive office by people who have pre-screened what is possible and what makes sense. So now we have to go and look at the situation that we are in without the blinders of the U.S. public intellectual body, of the U.S. news media. And in order to do that, we have to look backwards. And the history of Iran has been one of Western interference from 200 years ago. And in order to understand where we are today, we have to look at imperial interference of the great powers in the past. So I'm going to start at the end of the 19th century. Throughout the 19th century, of course, Iran was part of the great game, that is, a crossroads where Russia and Great Britain fought. But by the end of the 19th century, the Qajar Shahs of Persia were on the verge of an anti-imperial revolt in their country. That is, between 1900 and 1902, the rulers of Persia, the Qajar Shahs, lowered customs on Russian goods to help pay off the enormous loans they owed both to St. Petersburg and Great Britain. They had been attempting to play both sides in the great game. In order to pay these off, they also granted vast concessions in the form of oil monopolies to foreign powers. In particular, the most important concession was to the British industrialist William K. Darcy. A huge region of territory was ceded to Darcy, and that region at the time did not produce any oil. So it appeared to be a meaningless concession. However, by 1906, Persia owed £800,000 to Great Britain and £3,250,000 to Russia. It was deeply in debt. And in order to alleviate this debt, the Shah had begun to sell off portions of the country, essentially, in terms of tax farms, oil concessions, various industrial concessions. In 1905, there was a bad harvest followed by a cholera epidemic. Prices increased in 1905 sharply due to the Russo-Japanese War, which restricted trade from Japan. And as trade grew more restricted, the price of all of the items that were normally purchased through Russia, I'm sorry, did I say restricted trade through Japan? Restricted trade through Russia. Russia was fighting Japan, and the Tsarist Empire restricted the trade that was going out just due to demand in the East. That caused prices to rise in Iran, in Persia, which would later be Iran. In the first 3 months of 1905, sugar prices rose 33%, and the price of wheat rose 90%. And if there's any one theme that this podcast harps on, and I don't mean that as a pun, but it could be a pun, it's that the sudden precipitous rise in food prices is the powder that revolutions are made of. Demand to an end of international concessions and a relaxation of all the internal tariffs swept the peasantry and merchant class between 1905 and 1907. The mullahs supported the movement, and state intellectuals demanded an end to the vast corruption of the Shah's administration. The petite bourgeoisie organized secret societies beginning in 1904 and 05, and in late 1905, they appealed to the clergy and got them on their side. By 1906, they were openly confronting the government, and several main opposition leaders were arrested. However, at that time, the Shah was on his deathbed. In August of 1906, he agreed to the formation of a national consultative parliament and an electoral law granting suffrage to all male Iranian property-owning citizens over 30, regardless of religion. This was a huge change from the old order in Persia. The new constitutional monarchy did not persist with the accession of the new Shah, Muhammad Ali. He attempted to undermine the parliament and break the resolution of the united classes by giving concessions to major sectors of the petite bourgeoisie merchants and the burgeoning national bourgeoisie, particularly the big landowners. In 1908, having support of the major landowners, the Shah solicited foreign backing from the British and the Russians in order to regain control over the country, that is, to undermine the position of the democratic parliament that was operating as a constitutional parliament in a constitutional monarchy. Muhammad Ali used the Cossack Brigade, led by Russian officers and Russian-trained, to seize control of parliament and all of Tehran, and arrested the leaders of the constitutional reformist movement and executed them. The 1909 counteroffensive, led by the constitutionalists, marched on Tehran and, as a result, deposed the Shah. The new parliament formed a gendarmerie and hired Swedish officers to train it, that is, a police force throughout Persia. They hired an American economist named William Morgan Schuster to advise them on how to balance the Persian trade deficits and repair the bleeding of loan money that they owed to the imperial powers. The British and the Russians hated Schuster, particularly because he had an anti-imperialist bent. He wanted to tax the nobility, many of whom had deep loyalty to Russia, and install British tax collectors as opposed to the farmed-out Russian tax collectors in the north of Iran or Persia, which violated the Russian-Great Britain agreement to end the great game, but of which, of course, there was never any consultation with Persia. This treaty was included all of the spheres of influence in which Russia and Great Britain were permitted to make posts, and the north of Persia was reserved for Russian tax collectors. Because their treaty rights were violated by the Persians, the Russians got Britain's tacit approval and invaded northern Iran. This just happened right on the cusp of World War I. In 1914, World War I broke out. That was less than 2 years after the completion of the Constitutional Revolution. And the newly resurrected monarchy, that is the new Shah, who was reinstalled with the help of the Russians, declared Persia neutral. In 1911, Great Britain had converted the Royal Navy from coal-burning to oil-burning ships, and around that time, there was a discovery of oil inside Darcy's concession. That conversion from coal to oil was under the administratorship of none other than the monster Winston Churchill. Anyway, the Great British government purchased a 51% share of the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, which owned Darcy's concession, in order to make sure the Royal Navy had sufficient fuel. Following the war, British expeditionary forces mounted expeditions against communists from northern Persia. And northern Persia was a dense network of white sympathizers who had fled the collapse of the Tsarist Empire during World War I. Again, northern Persia was very close to Russia, both geographically and politically. By the end of the war, Britain controlled Persia. British troops had been deployed throughout the country, and London attempted to reduce Persia to a protectorate. The Anglo-Persian Agreement of 1919 granted Great Britain the exclusive right, and this is something that you'll recognize from other imperial conquests, the exclusive right to, one, provide all expert advisors, two, provide all officers to the army of Persia, three, supply the army. That's a contractorship supply, not to supply them for free, but to be hired to supply the army, and four, to build railroads, five, to build other infrastructure, and six, to develop a joint committee to revise the Persian tariff system to Great Britain's benefit. That is essentially to take over every major element of infrastructure and government inside of Persia and control it to Great Britain's benefit, to reap, basically to farm the government of Persia to reap rewards. And this, of course, caused widespread unrest. The Azerbaijanis formed an independent Azeri Republic in response and broke away from Persia. The British acted as though the treaty had been ratified by the Persian parliament when it had not, and simply went forward with their imperial designs. In 1921, Reza Khan, an officer and a commander in the Cossack Brigade, and who was a man who was close with many of the white officers, that is, the former Russian Tsarist officers, took control of Tehran by arresting prominent politicians, assuring the Shah that he had come to defend the monarchy, and installing his own choice as prime minister. By May of that year, he had named himself master of war, and in 1923, he appointed a new prime minister. 2 years later, in 1925, the parliament deposed the Qajar dynasty and named Reza Khan Shah. That is, you will probably more readily recognize him as Reza Khan Pahlavi. Four members of parliament alone opposed the accession. One of them, a European-educated Iranian nationalist named Mohammad Mossadegh. And you should remember that name. In 1930, Reza Shah attempted to tax, and this was his biggest mistake, of course, the Anglo-Persian Oil Company at a rate of 4%. The Anglo-Persian Oil Company had operated completely without tax during the time leading up to 1930. They had made huge profits and essentially extracting them in an imperial fashion from Persia. This 4% tax wasn't a special tax levied only at the APOC. It was a nationwide tax that simply happened to include the APOC. The APOC predictably refused to pay. In 1932, the Shah terminated the Darcy concession as a result. In April of 1933, the APOC reached a new agreement with the Shah after threatening to undermine the stability of the country. Subsequent to 33, Reza Shah began to flirt dangerously with the Nazis, changed the name of Persia to Iran, that is, the land of the Aryans. And as a result of his flirtations with Germany, both British and Soviet governments demanded Iran expel all Germans. When Reza Shah refused, there was a joint British and Soviet invasion of Iran. The withdrawing Red Army at the end of the war attempted to support the Tudeh Party in Iran, the Communist Party of Iran. Tudeh means, I believe, masses in Farsi. The USSR encouraged ethnic groups to form breakaway regions, as you would expect if you had read Stalin's National Question. The Red Army freed Kurdish, Azeri, and Communist prisoners from the Shah's jails and provided them with the funds and skills to go to the people to break free of foreign chains. In 1944, the new Shah clumsily attempted to rig the parliamentary elections, forming a broad coalition against him of all parties, nationalists, Tudeh, and very far rightists. the Tuda began striking and rioting, and the ruling classes of Iran saw out of this entire united front the Tuda as being the biggest threat, and the parliament began cracking down on that party as a result. The Soviets, in response, backed an Azeri separatist movement and helped develop an autonomous region within Iran. When the Iranian army responded, the Red Army blockaded the regions and kept the Iranian army out. The Kurds followed suit in 1946, and the Kurdish People's Republic immediately formed a mutual defensive alliance with Azerbaijan. Now, these sound like things that leftists have been talking about today within the past two decades. This is something that the USSR was attempting to do right on the end of World War II. This, of course, drew the NATO powers into conflict with the USSR. NATO forces were mobilized to deploy into Iran, so the USSR grudgingly withdrew under the policy of the CPC at the time, which was not to engage with NATO. The absence of the Red Army spelled the end for the newly formed People's Republics, and the Iranian Regular Army re-entered the regions and suppressed the national revolts that had been growing there. The Shah and the ruling classes of Iran sought protection from their people by increasing their dependence on the U.S., and the U.S. began to lend Iran money and arms to counter any perceived maneuvering by the Soviets in the region. This started U.S. interference in Iran, but was essentially a continuation of British and Russian interference in former Persia. In 1949, the Shah attempted to renegotiate the APOC, now the AIOC, because the name of the country had changed to Iran, oil concession, which had been returned to them in 1933 after being taken back by Reza Khan in 1932. Iran's nationalists wished to expel the imperial presence of Great Britain or else turn the terms of the highly exploitative concession to their benefit and the benefit of the people of Iran. The AIOC's executives were, in the words of a former CIA officer stationed in Iran, both numbingly greedy and terrifyingly insensitive. And, quote, many were astonished and even disappointed by the ingratitude of the Iranians for not being thankful to the AIOC for pumping, refining, and selling their oil for them. In 1949 through 50, there was another bad harvest in Iran, triggering a depression, and unrest followed. Iran demanded a nationalization of its oil fields and the end of the AIOC concession. In 1951, the UN Security Council took up the Iran-AIOC dispute. Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh represented the Iranian interests at the UN Security Council. Said Mossadegh of the British to the American ambassador to London, "You do not know how crafty they are. You do not know how evil they are. You do not know how they sully everything they touch." The UN Security Council, after hearing from both the government of Great Britain, which owned 52% of AIOC, and hearing from Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh and his sons, ruled in favor of Iran, agreeing that nationalization was an internal matter and not a matter of international law. As a result, in the following days, CIA operatives in Iran allied with the British intelligence and began making trouble both for the Tudeh Party and for Mossadegh. Britain established an embargo against Iran. This embargo is very important. It will now continue forward throughout our entire history. Britain embargoed Iran. Mossadegh, by then prime minister of Iran, got into a fight with the Shah over who would appoint the war minister. This was an internal political dispute between the Shah of Iran and the democratically elected prime minister. When the Shah refused to budge, Mossadegh resigned. The Shah appointed a pro-British prime minister, Ahmad Kavam, who had been in charge during the Soviet withdrawal and had overseen overtures to NATO. Kavam announced that he would reverse Mossadegh's policies and there would be no nationalization. This caused demonstrations to begin all over the country, and they spiraled out of control. 4 days of demonstrations basically seized the entire country into chaos. And the Shah asked Kavam to resign as a result, in fear for his own life, and recalled Mossadegh. This basically placed Mossadegh effectively in control of the entire country at the head of his National Front Unity Organization, which included the Tudeh Party. The question of nationalization, therefore, came to a head. In 1953, Mossadegh demanded an additional $50 million payment in damages from revenues the AIOC had stolen from Iran, in addition to the 50-50 profit split they were attempting to negotiate. The British, in response, began preparation for a coup. This is during a British embargo of the Iranian economy. Mossadegh closed the British embassy, till then open, cutting off MI6 from the country and removing their headquarters. He turned to the U.S. and seeking to play off fears of the Soviets, attempted to relieve the embargo strangling his country by communicating with Eisenhower. He told Eisenhower that if he didn't get what his people needed, he would have no choice but to turn to the USSR for supplies. An insider in the Eisenhower administration said that, quote, "While Truman and Akeson felt social change was inevitable and thus should be encouraged in a manner consistent with American interests, Eisenhower and Dulles tended to see reform movements as disruptive and as likely to be captured by local communists. The Iran experience marked the transition from a U.S. policy based on the first perception to one based on the second." The Dulles brothers began Operation Ajax, a program with the explicit goal of destroying the Mossadegh government and restoring the flow of oil from Iran. It was the Tudeh Party that paid the heaviest price after Operation Ajax. The combined CIA-MI6 program ousted Mossadegh, and Tudeh took to the streets in his support and against the imperialist interference and restoration of the Shah that Operation Ajax anticipated. The restoration regime gained power and control in using American influence, arrested 1,500 members of the party by the end of September 1953 and another 700 by year's end, devastating the Tudeh Party. The parliamentary elections of 1954 were openly rigged, and the subsequent political pogroms annihilated the remainder of the Tudeh Party and basically the parliament, turning it into a rubber-stamp body operated by the Shah and killing the constitutional revolution. That Shah was Mohammad Reza, began taking loans from U.S. financial institutions in the 60s to prop up his military. He instituted a failed land reform project to turn the huge regions of land that were owned by magnates into private farms, basically subdividing them too much, and stoked anger at imperial domination among the people by his behavior. In 1964, to a huge crowd, Ayatollah Khomeini said, "They have sold us. They have sold our independence." This speech was given in response to a new law passed by the Shah in exchange for loans. "If some American servant, some American's cook, assassinates your marja in the middle of the bazaar or runs over him, the Iranian police do not have the right to apprehend him. Iranian courts do not have the right to judge him. The dossier must be sent to the Americans so that our masters there can decide what is to be done. They have reduced the Iranian people to a level lower than that of an American dog. If someone runs over a dog belonging to an American, he will be prosecuted. But if an American cook runs over the Shah, the head of our state, no one will have the right to interfere with him. Why? Because they wanted a loan. And America demanded this in return." It should be no surprise that the Shah was then seen as a puppet of the imperial powers and, in effect, the tool of Western finance capital, and that he was subsequently overthrown by an internal coup. How did this happen? Oil revenues exploded in the early 70s from $885 million a year in 1971 to $17.8 billion a year in 1975 out of Iran. Tehran was suddenly flooded with money. The Shah began to purchase arms from the Nixon administration at an astronomical rate. This caused a crisis of overproduction. The crisis of overproduction began in Iran as the Shah pushed oil revenues higher. Pressure on labor grew to uncontrollable levels. The more the ruling class, who now composed an entire class of courtiers and the Shah, had, the more they wanted. The Shah's government botched a second land reform, trying to combine individual farms, which had been carved out of the wealthy magnate land in the 60s, by wholesale demolition of villages and transportation of unwilling populations. Food prices went up. Oil was producing, recall, $17.8 billion a year in 75. But in 1977, the oil market bottomed out due to the overproduction crisis. The price of oil crashed. 400,000 construction workers lost their jobs between 1977 and 1978. That crash could have been foreseen by any Marxian economist, and it reduced many in Iran to penury. Iran has historically, since the primacy of the oil market, been a target of imperial aggression. It was only with the great Iranian revolution, the Islamic revolution, that the vipers and vultures sucking from the teat of Tehran were finally driven off. The current stance of the West stems from this past. Because of the revolution, Iran refuses to be manipulated by finance, capital, or Western diplomacy, having seen all too well and firsthand the results of being made into American and British prey. They have been picked clean in the past. The Iranians do not trust the West, and for good reason. And they have seen the West's quote-unquote generosity, quote-unquote aid, to every region that borders them. What then are the roots of the current crisis? Iran is a regional power and has become such a power by rejecting its status as a puppet of the West. It stands as a counterbalance to the U.S. in the Middle East. It stands as a counterbalance to the U.S. puppet states of Israel and Saudi Arabia, which enforced U.S. authority in the region. It serves as the effective and de facto geopolitical leader of Shia nations, which are opposed to the U.S. proxy, the Sunni Saudi Arabia. It stood against the U.S. puppet of Saddam when he was in the U.S. orbit and continues to stand against the U.S. puppet powers of ISIS and the presence of U.S. military units in Syria and Iraq. We've seen that even more so today than yesterday. Literally today, the Iraqi parliament, as a result of this attack on their soil, has issued a proclamation requiring U.S. troops to withdraw. So the question, who is General Soleimani and why was he in Iraq? He was in Iraq to coordinate with the Iraqi people and help destroy ISIS and stabilize the region. General Soleimani was present to give aid to the Kaitab Hezbollah and the popular mobilization forces to coordinate assistance between Iran, Iraq, and Syria, and ultimately to expel the colonialist invaders. He has led the Iranian Quds force since he was basically a teenager and has fought in Syria, Iraq, and Iran. And it was bombing of Kataib Hezbollah militia strongholds that led to the popular storming of the U.S. embassy, which was in fact a base larger than Vatican City, in Iraq. That storming of that embassy is the supposed justification for the attack on General Soleimani. And several leaders of the popular mobilization forces died with General Soleimani in the rocket strike. It should be noted, by the way, that a war crime was committed with that strike, not only with the initial strike, which was a target against outside of a war zone against a civilian target that is a convoy, but with the second rocket as well, because they struck General Soleimani's convoy, waited for emergency workers to arrive, and then struck again with a second rocket to make sure they killed the emergency workers and no one could help him. The death of General Soleimani is the latest in this one step forward, one step back system of aggression committed by the Trump administration, this halting imperialism, if you will. Now, there are many reasons why there's not a full-throated imperialism yet, but we are getting to the stage where it will be here. This is a preparation for a war. Someone in the U.S. ruling class has finally impressed upon the current administration that the economy needs bolstering before it crashes. The destruction of U.S. military gear abroad and the creation of new markets and new sources of cheap labor and resources that would result from any war is the method par excellence of the imperial capitalist form. It is how they prevent the crisis of the falling rate of profit and overproduction from destroying the economy. They go to war. What can we do? The Plow and Stars, as an unofficial organ of the Party for Reclamation and Survival, calls upon all left anti-capitalist and anti-imperialist parties and orgs to endorse not only street marches, but to prepare for a general strike. Marching is the first and necessary phase. Marching demonstrates our commitment to liberals and assists in building an anti-war movement. We need desperately an anti-war movement again in the United States, like we had in the past. Marching is the way to begin building that again. We need to reach out and build coalitions with liberals. As distasteful as that may be to Marxists, it must be done. There is no way to do this without the masses. And the masses, though they are not ready to adopt Marxism, are ready to adopt an anti-war stance. But marching alone is not enough. Marching must be joined with concrete action. We must stop the United States Empire from engaging in a further criminal war. This is the time for parties like the Party for Socialism and Liberation, the Freedom Road Socialist Organization, the various Red Guards units, even the Green Party and Democratic Socialists of America to not only endorse a general strike, but to begin planning for one. The only thing that can stop the imperial warmongers is a strike of consumers and producers. There are moral reasons for this strike. The numberless lives of those opposed to U.S. imperialism that will be destroyed. That's reason number one. The oceans of blood that will flow as a result of a hot war or even a continued embargo. Reason number two. Let us not forget who will pay the price. The working people of the U.S. must join with the people of Iran and Iraq to oppose the actions of our criminal government and its jackbooted lackeys. We must stand up, for we are the very engines of empire on which they rely to prosecute their wars. There are also pragmatic reasons. A war will buoy up the empire and provide succor to the fascists that run this settler colony. Open warfare will accelerate the dialectic dangerously quicker and move us ever closer to fascist takeover. When the troops come home from a war abroad, they will exercise what they learned there, abroad, in the battlefield, on the people here at home. Do not forget that the concentration camps here will become extermination camps, and the accelerant of war will only see this happen sooner. Further, in exercising their power, the working masses will awaken to their might, and the producing class will see what it can do. Even if they are not yet ready to adopt the rubric of revolution, they can go out there and realize the strength that lies inherent in the producing class when it moves in mass mobilization, when it moves in mass refusal to work. A general consumer and producer strike is the second phase of our efforts. The Party for Reclamation and Survival is preparing materials to distribute and asking for any other parties, all other parties, to join in calling for such a strike to cripple the war capacity of the United States. Nothing else will stop deployment. Nothing else will stop the advance of fascism. The hour is now. Though our putative masters, who believe they hold the reins, have declared their intentions to make unjust and evil war, it is within our power to check them. Because it lies within our strength, we must act. No war can be won or carried out without the support of the masses. No army can persecute its objectives without logistical support. There is no army on earth that can continue to fight without a secure rear guard. The war machine must fall. We are on the brink of combat. The United States, the most evil nation to exist in the history of the world, must lose. Please contact me or any of the Plow and Stars hosts to help coordinate the coming efforts. Reach out to your party leadership and tell them that now is the time to plan for a general strike. Reach out to us so we can communicate with them. I implore every organization out there, every member of every organization who listens to this podcast, who looks and sees the need for a general strike, to talk to me or one of our other hosts, to talk to a member of the Party for Reclamation and Survival, to talk to their own party leadership and tell them that we must stop the advance of empire. With all luck, I will see you all on the battlefield.